signals intelligence support to the combined bombing offensive 1943 to 1945. A 47-minute presentation for the Defence Electronics History Society, held in the Armoured Fighting Vehicle Wing Lecture Theatre at the Defence Academy, Shrivenham, on the 8th of May 2008. The speaker is Wing Commander retired John Stubbington, who graduated from the Royal Air Force Technical College, Henlow, in 1961. His RAF career to 1985 became specialised in electronic warfare and technical intelligence, including 3 years with the US Air Force Intelligence Division. He left the RAF with the rank of Wing Commander, and subsequently worked for 20 years in the UK defence industry as an independent consultant in C4 ISTAR. Wing Commander John Stubbington.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. If I apologise to start with for bringing you inside on a day like this, it ain't my fault. That was the only apology that I proposed to make until the end, when I will probably say I'm sorry that I've scampered through so much in so short a time before so many skilled people. I'm going to talk about signals intelligence, most particularly about the Y Service and Bletchley Park. The product which they produced and contributed to, particularly during the combined bombing offensive through 1943 through 45. And what I intend to say is not how did we get Enigma, how did we create Ultra, because I believe that that has been done in the most kindest way to death, and I'm quite sure that you know as much or more about it than I. What I propose to talk about is the way in which it was used, as distinct from the way in which it was collected and decrypted. The introduction and general background. By way of background, I'm going to very quickly scamper over the different players that were associated with the operational application of the signals intelligence. I should clearly be talking about then the Y Service and Bletchley, and what sort of thing did they produce? I should be talking about things called the BMP reports and the hookup. I'm quite sure that some of you, possibly many of you, may know something about that already. And finally, what a little bit about target selection and some of the politics that came into the exercise. Essentially, there were those five major elements. I haven't yet mentioned the United States Army Air Force. They were the other major contributor to the combined bombing offensive. Neither have I mentioned number 100 Bomber Support Group, which I strongly suspect that you will well appreciate. Their business was the radio countermeasures. And by no means least, we must not lose sight of the combined bombing offensive directives, those things that purported to tell the bomber forces, that was Bomber Command and the United States Army Air Forces, by that I mean the 8th Air Force in UK and the 15th in the Mediterranean, basically what their target should be. I'll come back to that, because what they should be wasn't necessarily always what they were. And I should say something about the German night fighter system. Let's start off with the Casablanca Conference, January 1943. The outcome of that, as far as I'm concerned now, is the definition and the creation of the combined bombing offensive. The objective of that, as I say on the screen here in about one sentence as distinct from five or six pages, the progressive destruction and dislocation of the German military, industrial and economic system, big emphasis on the economic system, and the initial targets as approved at the Point Blank Conference in May, submarine construction yards, aircraft industry, transportation, oil, and other targets. Those priorities change from time to time, as I suspect you probably well know. As far as Bomber Command was concerned, when it went into the war, it actually was completely poorly equipped. I will say, from the position of having been part of air intelligence, albeit not at that time self-evidently, that air intelligence played no great part in the early part of the bombing strategy. The losses that we sustained in daylight were quite simply unaffordable, so we were moved to go to night bombing, and there were several problems that arose with that. The major ones were, where the hell's the aeroplane? And the next equally major one was, where the hell's the target? And if you get those things sorted out, you're in good shape. But for a long time, we had neither of those things sorted out. The initial attacks to mid-1942 really did not have a great deal of impact. Specific attacks on specific targets, yes. But as a generally successful exercise, it was not. Then we began to get some aeroplanes that were rather better suited for the purpose. And please, at that time, I am not saying that aeroplanes like the Wellington and the Hampton were poor or bad aeroplanes. I am simply saying they were not capable of doing the job that was expecting to be done. I've got several pictures in just to sort of entertain you on the way. The top picture is significant only in the sense that it's a 617 squadron aeroplane at the very point of release of a tall boy. The bomb has just detached. It was a £22,000 version. The target was the Arnsberg Viaduct. The viaduct ceased to function. The Mosquito, I say nothing about the Mosquito other than the fact that most of the people who knew about these things regarded the Lancaster and the Mosquito as the best aircraft in their types at the time. Certainly the German night fighter system had immense respect for the Mosquito when they were used as intruders. This is only by way of background, please. The war in the ether, as it was described by the signals people in Bomber Command headquarters. We didn't actually start countermeasures until October 1942. There was considered political military opinion that to start countermeasures could provoke a countermeasure war, which could be just as damaging to ourselves as it could be to the enemy. There are a number of aspects of getting into the countermeasures war. How actually did the enemy air defence system work? This is where we will find that the Y Service and Bletchley were very significant contributors. What equipment should we use on the aeroplanes? All of this stuff was being developed pretty much in real time through organisations such as TRE at Malvern. Having got the equipment out of the laboratory into a working state, we then had to decide how to actually put it in the aeroplane. That had some impact upon the bombers. It did affect their payload. It did also have some impact upon their range because they were carrying that extra weight. Just by way of weight, probably the heaviest equipment was the Jostle equipment, HF Jammer. 600 pounds of weight. And finally, what about tactics? It's very nice having jammers. How do you use them? Against what do you use them, when, and for how long? That demands tactical intelligence. Again, we come back to the Y Service and Bletchley. The 8th Air Force came to the table at an operational capability level in the third quarter of 1942. Actually, for the time through 1942 until early into 1943, they hardly engaged targets in Germany. The majority of their early efforts were against targets in France and the Low Countries, and one of their key targets, let me go back to the point-blank directive, was against the submarine resources, particularly, but not only, on the Bay of Biscay. Their early raids illuminated their thinking. And please, I've spent time in America, I've worked with the American Air Force, I have great respect for them. But when they came to the table in the combined bombing offensive, they had the perception and the argument that they were going to deliver precision bombing. They had demonstrated that they could do that fairly effectively in Texas. That didn't travel across the Atlantic very well. Big differences. A, there was an opposition. B, there was often a lot of cloud. The opposition was unkind enough to have smoke decoys. And the great skill of dropping bombs in a precision mode demanded visual acquisition of the target. If you can't see the target, precision goes out of the window. And the statistics show that the amount of time that they were able to use good to medium visual conditions was probably something less than 40%. In the process, they lost a lot of aeroplanes. And they were very concerned about the defence of their bombers. They had far more guns than did ours. But one of the techniques which was evolved, and I think I would have to say operationally a very effective technique, the technique was developed by Curtis LeMay, then a colonel with one of the bomb groups in the 8th. He, as I'm sure you know, went on to become commander of Strategic Air Command. He developed the combat box structure, in which they really had formations of B-17s or Liberators in close formation, flying as a group, and the bombardier in the lead aircraft effectively was the bombardier for the group. The principal aim of the box was defence, because they were structured and positioned in such a way that their onboard armament, each B-17 I think had 10.5-inch guns. That's quite a lot of armament. When you get that together in a group of 50 or 100 aeroplanes, that's quite a defensive capability. For the purposes of today, the key thing is that in May 43, the US War Department and Bletchley came to agreements on the way in which they were going to work together on cryptologic and SIGINT exploitation. The military advisers began to arrive at Bletchley, and particularly, they were working, amongst other things, in Hut 3. Now, that is absolutely fundamental, because those advisers quite properly had the option to select ultra material and make that available directly to their field commanders. Please bear that in mind. The German night fighter system. In a German high command meeting just before the war, that statement at the top in red, night fighting, it'll never come to that, was one of the things noted in the minutes. Well, that was another good idea that actually didn't stand up very long. Göring set about creating a night fighter system when he instructed Kammhuber to begin to think about the way of doing things. And what they did, I think, was absolutely admirable. What I show there in red are the line of sights of their ground control intercept services that were deployed by the back end of 1942. All of the black blobs represent independent ground-controlled intercept stations as they were developed as the war went through, but most particularly by the middle of 1943. Bearing in mind that in 1940 they start off with nothing, that's pretty good. And the other thing is that it worked. The sort of equipment that they were using, and this is just a sample of it, the ground-based Würzburg radar, which was effectively a target tracking radar. One of those radars would track the bomber, a bomber. Another one of those radars would track a German fighter. And they would, through GCI, ground-controlled intercept, steer the fighter to the bomber. The sort of equipment that they were using in the air included the Junkers 88 with Liechtenstein, early generation airborne radar, air-to-air intercept radar. Were they successful? I think they were pretty good. These are average statistics through the 41-45 period. And just as a matter of numbers, if we take the 1943 figure of 5% increasing, that means that on average, Bomber Command was losing 5% of each mission that it flew. Now, typically by that time, the mission size was certainly into hundreds, often 500, occasionally 1,000. Let's just take a number of 500, which was by no means untypical. 5% of that is 25 aeroplanes and 150 aircrew, and that's on a nightly basis. 100 Bomber Support Group. When it began to be appreciated and approved that we should use countermeasures, 100 Bomber Support Group was set up in the back end of 1943. Most of their bases were located in East Anglia. They started off with 192 and 141 squadron. I particularly mention 192, and please forgive my divergence. 192 after the war renumbered to 51. 51 flies today. Currently they're flying Nimrod R's in the Afghanistan-Iraq situation. My association only en passant was that I was the engineer officer with 51 a long, long, long time ago. Their final order of battle, 15 squadrons over 200 aeroplanes. each aeroplane, Halifax's, Fortress, Liberators, Stirlings, notably no Lancasters. Why no Lancasters? Because Sir Arthur Harris was more concerned about using his Lancasters to drop bombs than to provide countermeasure support. That's not a bad thing. The Lancaster was an excellent aeroplane for that. So 7 squadrons of heavy jammers and 7 squadrons of Mosquitoes doing intruder support. They really worried the night fighter system that the Germans used. Typically a B-17 Fortress, a 214 squadron. And this, just typically, is the sort of mission that 100 Group would be doing pretty much on a day-by-day basis. One of the better books about 100 Group has the title, Even When the Sparrows Are Walking. The point there was that when the weather was too bad for Bomber Command to fly, 100 Group would fly. Why would they fly? To exercise the enemy air defence system and keep them agitated. On this particular night, 29th, 30th of December 44, the major functions from 100 Group point of view, screen the main bomber force with Mandrel. Mandrel, the radar jammers. Provide diversionary spoof forces with window and also with countermeasures. Jam the radars and the communication. Engage the night fighters and attack their airfields with the intruder forces. This picture is actually one of the pictures that is the sort of thing that was produced at Bletchley Park. I'm coming to this in more detail in slower time. But on this particular screen, let me just sort of point out some of the ingredients. The route of the bombers going into the target. The target in this case was Vessel. The route of the bombers shown in black. The Mandrel screen provided by 100 Group was curving across the route of the bombers. This was a line of aircraft that would be flying this route, aiming their jamming into this sector. Window was being dropped at the same time. And window, of course, doesn't stay there. It needs to be reseeded. So it was an ongoing operation. And you'll see from these black arrows over here that the bulk of the night fighter activity was circulating over here. The bombers were over here. These extracts over here are extracts from the BMP reports that Bletchley Park was producing against every raid. There's much more to say on that. The Y service itself, I'm just talking now about the RAF Y service, not the Navy, not the Army, not the Foreign Office service or even the radio service. This was the RAF service and there were 3 major stations. Cheadle was particularly concerned with HF and MF. West Kingsdown in Kent was probably the most active so far as the bomber support operations were concerned. Chicksands focused largely, not exclusively, largely on Enigma intercept. Let's just get our minds around the size. Each of those 3 major stations had a number of subordinate, subsidiary stations, which I'm sure some of you, maybe all of you, will immediately recognise as the Home Defence Units. There were over 25 such units within UK at the end of 1941 with 3,500 people. They were working a 24/7 operation. There was immense controversy about the business of cryptanalysis, particularly, if not exclusively, related to the Enigma product, the Ultra. That was made available to a very small number of people, but it had some gems of information in it. And the great trick at Bletchley was how to make any use of that in an operational context. If I go to the other end of the scale, to what we would call the low-grade and the medium-grade SIGINT, basically radio telephony, wireless telephony stuff, much of that was encrypted. A lot of it was, of course, also plain voice, albeit coded voice. The trick was to put those 2 sets of information together and to come out with a sensible answer. And the huge problem for quite a long time, and I'm not sure that the problem ever really went away, was how to do what today we call fusion. What happened early on was that the ultra reports were compartmented, put into this box, and were seen by these people. The material that was being generated by the low and medium grade SIGINT, and this was not just an Air Force problem, was being seen by other people, because those people weren't allowed to see the ultra product. And usually the people who saw the ultra product were the very senior people who couldn't be bothered, sorry, that's a very rude thing, but I will say it notwithstanding, couldn't be bothered to look at the mass of low and medium grade traffic. This got sorted out in the air section at Bletchley Park. I must just say here, Air Ministry Intelligence, a massive department. It started the war, I think, with about 40 people. By the end of 43, early 44, there were over 700 people. Now that's quite a heavy growth rate. And one of the aside observations which several people make, and I'm afraid I am one of them quite loudly, is that you cannot suddenly pitch up with 660 intelligence officers. I didn't say intelligent, I said intelligence officers. Please make what you will of that. But you cannot just pitch up with that number of people when people with that sort of skill are also being looked for by the Army and the Navy and the research establishments and some parts of industry. There were serious problems in the Air Intelligence organisation. I am saying much more clearly in a book which is currently in draft that many of those problems did not get resolved. I like the comment by Professor Jones. Some of you probably will have had the pleasure of meeting Professor Jones. I certainly did. I think Dick did. But I think that comment is very apt. The only thing that I would amplify that with is saying, that wasn't just relevant in the 1940s. I think it has substantial resonance today. Because of this problem of ultra being over here, and you're not allowed to see it, an ordinary RTWT SIGINT over here, the air section at Bletchley, which was actually part of Air Intelligence in London, was AI4F. Until the spring of 1942, had to send all of their reports to Air Intelligence in London, full stop. What Air Intelligence did with them was their business. But the great problem was that Bletchley, or more particularly the air section, was forbidden to have direct contact with the users of intelligence. At the same time, there was a critical lack of communication, and I would say not just within Bletchley. I think many people, perhaps many of you have been to Bletchley, many of you have known people who were working there. Many people worked in little boxes and really didn't know what was going on around the rest of the system. Of course, there were a small number of people who knew the whole story. But communication was not good. Communication between Bletchley and London was seriously handicapped. Capacity was the problem. And communication in London, forgive me, ladies, was damn awful. Mostly because of the interpretation of the regulations about the dissemination of the material. There were two major examples of how to do it better, I have to say. And forgive me, I would look at our Navy friend in the corner here, and I see the Navy, Naval Operational Intelligence, I believe nearly got it right during the Battle of the Atlantic. But I think in part that was because, forgive the phrase, they got off their butts and made it work. I do not believe that the Air Force did that to the same effect. The BMP reports. What actually is BMP? An American book of substance on the subject calls them British military paper. Neat, plausible, wrong. They're actually the initials of the three people in the air section who created the report. Bill Bonsall, Moyes and Pryor. Bill Bonsall, I'm delighted to say, is fully active and running to this day. And he has been kind enough to have a look at what I've written so far and hasn't shot it down. He, in his spare time after the war, my words, not his, he became director of GCHQ. They were able, with the fractional access that they had to ULTRA, to be able to make sense of the early fusion process. And they began to see that they could look at what was happening during a bomber raid, listening to the German RT traffic, their WT, looking at the Enigma Ultra product which they had in hand, and making operational sense of what was being said. What sort of things are we talking about? Ground controllers issuing commands to airborne fighters. Airborne fighters responding to those commands. It's quite wrong to suggest that everything they said was heard. What I can only say is that everything that they said was a radio transmission and could have been heard had we had a channel tuned to that frequency at that time. But a greater majority of it was heard, and great sense was made of it. The first BMP report was issued the day after the 1,000 bomber raid on Cologne. It took a little while for air intelligence in London, from a protocol and a chain of command point of view, to actually acknowledge the operational value of what the air section was doing. Some months went by before the air section was regarded as an intelligence production centre. And that is fundamentally novel in the Air Force, because the Air Force thinking was that intelligence came out of air intelligence in London and nobody else would know. Through the latter part of 1943, the progressive opening up of the whole of the air section staff to the Enigma Ultra service made the BMP reports much better. Ultra, in a way, is not a tactical message. In some cases, it had tactical application, but the bulk of it was not real-time stuff. The real-time stuff was really the RT and the WT. But, as happened many times at, say, West Kingsdown, with their home defence units in Kent, they would listen to some traffic, and on the basis of that, they would be able to make a very reasonable judgment. It's quite possible, and in some cases, that judgment was wrong, because there was Enigma material in the background which would be able to straighten it out. So one of the great benefits here was that the intelligence, the reported intelligence, actually became more accurate. Dissemination was still a problem. The appreciation function of air intelligence cost time. Operationally, time was gold. Bletchley were producing, quite apart from BMPs, the air section there were producing whole numbers of specialist reports on particular subjects. CXMSSX, what does all that mean? CX basically is the acronym associated with an agent report. MSS is quite simply most secret source. X is an identification that this goes into special boxes. Just note the CX agent report drew back to the image that Churchill had in fact created when he referred to the Ultra product as Boniface. Boniface was the agent who never existed. Boniface was Ultra. But number 32 in that series of reports generated by Bletchley was the first one to go directly to Bomber Command Headquarters. The subject is very right, German aircraft reporting system. But you might think that methods of German Air Force night fighting and the running commentary control of night fighters would have a bit to do with it as well, wouldn't you? That didn't get to Bomber Command. What it did is went through the appreciation process in London and came out in a fashion which was probably the best analysis at the time. This daily BMP that I'm referring to, it included what was the Bomber Command plan? What were they going to do that night? What did the German Air Force system make by way of response? Which squadrons, groups were scrambled? What vectors were they scrambled on? What beacons were they held over? What directions did they get to engage with the bombers? All of the information in yellow there, RT comms, night fighter patrols, altitudes, pursuits and vectors, engagements, all of that material was in the BMP report. It was a report of some 3, 4, 5, 6 pages or so, and the trick was that they became obligated to get the preliminary version of that. Remember, this is the night's bombing, which the report probably wasn't drafted until 5, 6, 7 o'clock in the morning. The primary mission was to get the preliminary version to Bomber Command Headquarters at High Wycombe for the morning briefing at 9 o'clock. That was only the preliminary version. Another one of these pictures. This time I'm just going to refer to this selection of boxes all over the place. This was actually generated by the air section, not by me. And it's part of a BMP report, which shows the colours, incidentally, are mine. But the black lines and things are what was on the report as it was generated out of Bletchley. And all of these things are the highlight information that they had from the RT, etc., of the various squadrons that were engaging or trying to engage the incoming bombers. You might well recognise that the BMP report was always written after the raid. As such, it could not help what was going on during the raid. This is where we get into something rather different. The Kingsdown hookup. It had been done before, during the Battle of Britain, that there was a lesser hookup. Lesser, I don't mean that in any diminishing sense. There weren't as many players in the hookup, which on this occasion, of course, was focused to fighter command. And in that sense, the Y Service and the Home Defence Units were providing fighter command headquarters with advice on raids as they were forming and as they were approaching UK coasts. During the bomber offensive, the hookup was expanded. The major units, the Y Service at the top, I put them at the top because if there had been no Y Service, had they not been doing this, none of the rest would have happened. They were the seed corn. Bletchley, in this sense, were there to, this is Bletchley Air Section, were there to provide the expert advice coming from the background of their Enigma Ultra knowledge. Bomber Command Headquarters Ops Room, 100 Group Headquarters Ops Room. A dedicated secure telephone teleprinter network tying all this lot together. Prior to and during the bomber operations, each of those sets, telephones, positions was continuously manned. Or, forgive me ladies, I don't know what the analysis is to say, many of the operators actually were ladies. And many of them were regarded as better at their job than some of the men. I don't begin to get into the politics or the personalities of that, but they were astonishingly good. And voice messages were passed instantly around this link. The typical things that they were reporting around the hookup link: plots on Allied aircraft, time, place, takeoff of landing of German units, their vectors, altitude, speed, combat engagements with Allied aircraft, tactical organisation of the German Air Force as it was deployed. The trick, which is still very impressive, is that they were supplying Bomber Command and the 8th with their enemy intentions and their execution. I identified on the previous slide the sort of priority material, and the time zone was that from the RT, say, from a German controller to a German fighter, from the point at which that was said to the point at which it was to be reported, if it was regarded as valuable, was 1 minute. And that was done. That's not bad. Even in today's wonderful language, we're pushed to do that sort of fusion, analysis and reporting. It was comparatively simple stuff. Very, very briefly, into the Combined Strategic Targets Committee. Five principal subcommittees: transport, oil, air force, armour, ammunition and filling. Filling is a sort of catch-all for things that didn't fit into the first four. Ultra became available, and I specifically refer to Ultra now with much less attention to low and medium grade SIGINT, to provide very real information on the analysis of the bombing raids as seen by the enemy. During the early part of the war, much of their reporting system was conducted on landline, telephone, teleprinter, whatever. As the bombing offensive went through, much of that communication infrastructure was damaged or destroyed. They were then committed to going on air. And a lot of that on air was using Enigma. That then became exploitable. And in that, we were seeing what sort of damage was actually done to this factory, or this railway, or this plant? What were our plans to repair that damage? Perhaps on some occasions we're not going to try and repair that damage. On other occasions, in conjunction with photographic reconnaissance, you could find some interesting examples of the roof being blown off and therefore visible to the camera, and therefore you might say factory badly damaged. It could be that the factory was still working, even though the roof wasn't there. I use this statement almost as light relief, but it wasn't light relief at the time. This was said formally by the Deputy Supreme Commander, Sir Arthur Tedder, at a moment of some exasperation. The letter was addressed to the Chief of Air Staff, and it referred to the activities of the target committee. The problems that presented themselves at Bomber Command headquarters, the quality of the material from the target committee, I am not saying that there was anything amiss with the people in the target committee, far be it. I'm quite sure that they all were doing a hard job. But the information that they had was by no means complete and often was imperfect. The diversity of targets and their locations that were being generated. I've got one slide which I'm not using today, in which the priority targets for this day number something like 75 different targets. Hang on, guys. From the Bomber Command point of view, and this was also true for the American Air Force point of view, what actually was their capability and availability? What actually was the weather? And what was the status of the German defence? These are operational questions that come into the business of deciding which target for tonight or today. At the strategic levels, the material that Bletchley and the Y service, and I can put that the other way around, the Y service and Bletchley, was making available primarily to the people in town, the industrial capacities, their productivity and economic factors, theatre level planning and coordination. What actually were different parts of the enemy organisation doing? Not tactically on the Western Front, but what were they doing on the Eastern Front, the Mediterranean? What was the sort of consensus of all that? The bottom one is particularly relevant, bomb damage assessment. I mentioned before the value as the war went through, timescales really from sort of late 1943 onwards, the increasing value of ULTRA in damage assessment. At the tactical level, I believe I would say I've covered that with the BMP reports and the hookup. That was what they were doing at a tactical level. One of the things that some people, many people in many respects, tended to regard Enigma and ULTRA not just as a most powerful piece of intelligence, but as the only piece of intelligence. And that was fundamentally wrong. There was much intelligence that came from other sources. And there is a paper, an analysis, written out of the Joint Intelligence Committee after the war, which reflects, with the benefit then of hindsight, on their use of the ULTRA material. And there were some most interesting observations in there. It reports that some people believed that if they saw anything in ULTRA, it had to be. And conversely, if it didn't appear in ULTRA, then it was impossible. There was an absolute sort of black and white interpretation by some people. The fact that signals intelligence, and some of us have worked for a long time in signals intelligence, is never a complete source of information. You actually don't know what you didn't hear. You may hear the order, but you didn't hear the response from the guy down the road who said, "Colonel, I can't do that." Or you didn't hear the counter order which said, "Forget what I said 5 minutes ago, do something else." SIGINT is very valuable, but it is never, I think I would say safely, never complete.
Wing Commander Stubbington was asked 5 questions. Question 1. You showed the attrition rate at the beginning. How did all this affect the rate of attrition at the end?
I would venture the impression that the attrition rate at the beginning and the circumstances as obtained at the beginning set, if you like, paths through which the bombing offensive evolved. But I wouldn't like to see that there was a connection between what happened at the beginning and what happened at the end. I think it's a multifaceted equation. I don't believe there's an immediate connection.
Question 2. You haven't mentioned the aircraft that flew along with the bombers to gain intelligence. Can you say how and where this intelligence was used, together with all the other information?
Primarily, not exclusively, but primarily within the Royal Air Force, that work was mostly done by 192 Squadron. They were the signals intelligence airborne collectors. looking at communications, looking at radars, looking at signals which weren't even operational signals. Probably one of the major differences with the US Air Force in that sense, if I may be very sort of rather quick in that sense, bearing in mind that they were flying daylight operations and that they eventually realised the necessity of going to the table with extensive escort fighters. What I had failed to mention was that the hookup service that was working in daylight for the 8th Air Force was actually having a direct interface with the squadron and wing commanders of the escort fighters on mission. And the sort of information that they were then being provided with was such and such a unit has just scrambled, this is a German air defence unit, has just scrambled, and their vector altitude speed is X. And you could then put that together in terms of the position of the escort fighters in tactical relation to the bomber group that they were looking after. There was a very positive connection between some of the signals collection at the time by the bombers and the operations in hand. The American Air Force, I think, were very, very much more proactive than we were.
Question 3. R.V. Jones, in his treatise, was in favour of talking to people at the cutting edge, such as aircrew.